Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a few moments, a top Vatican official visits one of the most important centres of learning in the Islamic world. Behind the scenes at a crucial meeting of Anglican bishops in Dar es Salaam, a new initiative to increase the church's pastoral ministry to the homosexual community in the City of London. But first, Pope Benedict begins a week of spiritual exercises for the Lenten season. Welcome to the programme. Pope Benedict and many of his closest advisers are spending this first week of Lent on a spiritual retreat here in the Vatican. Following the tradition of his predecessors, the Pope suspends all public and private audiences for this coming week and takes part in a daily program of spiritual exercises, led this year by the former Archbishop of Bologna, Cardinal Giacomo Biffi. Speaking to pilgrims and visitors gathered for his Angelus address in St. Peter's Square on Sunday, Pope Benedict asked for prayers from the faithful to accompany him during this week of meditation. My colleague Catherine Smybert takes a closer look at what the Pope had to say.
Today, the first Sunday of Lent, we are invited to contemplate Jesus as an example of how to conduct our daily struggle against temptation.
Speaking to the crowd gathered in St. Peter's Square for this weekly Angelus, Pope Benedict said that the crucifix is the source from which we can draw the indispensable spiritual energy to build peace and happiness.
May this time of purification prepare our hearts to celebrate the saving mysteries of the death and the resurrection of Christ.
The Pope, deriving his Angelus reflection from his Lenten message, entitled They Shall Look on Him Whom They Have Pierced, said, in these days of Lent, let us not remove our hearts from this mystery of profound humanity and high spirituality. By looking at Christ on the cross, he suggests, let us feel that he is looking at us.
Chiediamo alla Vergine Maria.
Pope Benedict concluded by calling on the Virgin Mary to help gain a firm faith whose soul, he said, was pierced near her son's cross. Guiding us on the Lenten path, may she help us, he said, put aside all that distracts us from listening to Christ and his word of salvation.
Invocando la potenza divina su ciascuno di voi.
It's with these words that the Pope entrusted the Virgin Mary with the spiritual exercises for this week. The Holy Father appealed to the faithful to accompany the group with our prayers, which he said he will gladly return by way of meditation, invoking the divine power for each one of us, our families and communities.
I wish you all a pleasant stay in Rome and a blessed Sunday.
And my thanks to Catherine Smybert for that report on Pope Benedict's Angelus address. This weekend marks the anniversary of Pope John Paul's visit to Egypt in the year 2000 as part of his pilgrimage to the places which marked our Christian history of salvation. During that visit, he prayed at the foot of Mount Sinai, but also stressed the need for dialogue with followers of the other monotheistic religions at a meeting in Cairo's Al-Azhar University, one of the most important centres of learning in the Islamic world. To mark this anniversary, the current head of the Vatican's Councils for Interreligious Dialogue and Culture, Cardinal Paul Poupart, was in Cairo last week with an invitation to the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar, Sheikh Mohammed Sayed Tantawi, to visit the Vatican. Accompanying the Cardinal was Archbishop Michael Fitzgerald, formerly head of the Council for Interreligious Dialogue and currently Apostolic Nuncio to Egypt and the Arab League.
We were very well received in Al-Azhar. Cardinal Poupart, who mentioned that he had had an audience with Pope Benedict XVI just before coming to Cairo, and that the Pope reconfirmed his wish to receive Sheikh Al-Azhar, Sheikh Tantawi, in Rome, if he would be able to come, and the Sheikh accepted immediately. Of course, the details have to be worked out, and they said they would need a letter, of invitation, so this is not yet fixed, but there is a good hope that this visit of Sheikh Al-Azhar will take place. On the same morning, we went also to the Minister of Religious Affairs, Dr. Hamdi Zakzouk, and we were very cordially received there. And Dr. Zakzouk is someone who has taken part in many dialogues, particularly with Cardinal Koenig. It's interesting because, Cardinal Koenig had been appointed president of the Council for Non-Believers, and Cardinal Poupart succeeded to Cardinal Koenig in that position. But Cardinal Koenig had come to Al-Azhar in 1964 and gave a remarkable talk on monotheism, which is it's a date that people look back to here. There is that date of Cardinal Koenig's visit, and then the other is the year 2000 and the visit of Pope John Paul II. These are, I would say, the high points, in a sense, at the beginning and more recently, the relations between the Al-Azhar and the Holy See. We'd also paid a visit on the previous day, on the Monday, to an advisor of President Mubarak, Dr. Omar Al-Baz, who is a religious leader, and he advises the president on religious matters, and we had a very good conversation with him, too. There were other activities also that took place. On the last day, the Cardinal Poupart went to Alexandria and visited the Biblioteca Alessandrina, this wonderful new library that has been built there. Other elements of the visit were more with the Catholic Church. We had a very good meeting with all the Catholic bishops of the country. The Coptic bishops were in synod, and so they were all gathered here, and the other bishops of the different rites came, and we had an exchange, and the cardinal was able to listen to the views of the different people on their concrete dialogue with Muslims in this country, not only from bishops, but also from the representatives of the religious, both men and women. And I think that was also a very good exchange. And then the following day, the cardinal paid a visit to the major seminary and met with the staff and students. He gave a talk and he answered their questions. And I think all that also contributes to strengthening this spirit of dialogue and openness to the exchange, both on a cultural and a religious level.
A representative of Al-Azhar is now over in the Vatican for a part of a regular series of meetings. What hopes do you have that that kind of dialogue also will bear some important fruit in the near future?
Yes, the meetings have been taking place these last few years, always on or around the 24th of February, which was the date of the visit of Pope John Paul II to Al-Azhar. It was the Muslim side that suggested that the annual meeting should take place at that date in order to keep alive the memory of this visit. So it is, I think, significant that somebody from Al-Azhar is coming to Rome. The person who is coming is a member of the Committee for Islamic Research, which is one of the bodies of Al-Azhar. Al-Azhar is not just a university, it has also its networks of schools, and it has various activities, and including this activity of research. So here's one of the professors who is coming to Rome and who will discuss with people in the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue.
Looking back, of course, to that visit of Pope John Paul's to Al-Azhar in the year 2000, there was a real sense of expectation about progress in interreligious dialogue. How would you personally, with your many years of experience in this field, characterize the atmosphere at the moment?
Well, the dialogue never takes place in a vacuum, and there are so many events around the world and near us here. I mean, you think of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the war in Iraq, the war in Lebanon last year and the ongoing unrest in the Lebanon, all this has its impact on dialogue because this influences public opinion. And very often the West is seen as interfering in Arab affairs, and the West is seen as Christian. And so there is a kind of feeling of resentment. And the dialogue has to, as it were, combat that. And so you're always battling in a way to build up confidence. But there are people who are strongly dedicated to this, and the conversations that took place during these meetings were really insisting on the oneness of the human family, and that we must not allow ourselves to be divided in this way. We must not allow religion to be manipulated in order to divide people. That religious leaders have a responsibility in this line. So I think that this, whereas the present climate popularly is perhaps not favorable to dialogue, at the higher level, I think there is a consciousness of the great importance of this dialogue.
My thanks there to Archbishop Michael Fitzgerald, former head of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue and currently Apostolic Nuncio to Egypt and the Arab League. Anglican leaders last week concluded a six-day meeting in Tanzania with a statement that aims to promote reconciliation between the conservative and liberal wings of the worldwide communion. The communique issued late last Monday contains a series of practical provisions to overcome the crisis that erupted following the 2003 consecration of an openly homosexual bishop in the United States. Media reports from the meeting in Dar es Salaam suggested the communion was on the verge of a breakup after a number of conservative Anglican bishops refused to take communion with the head of the Episcopal Church in the United States, Bishop Catherine Jeffert Shorey. But other observers see the meeting as an important and positive step forward towards the key Lambeth Conference of all Anglican bishops in England next year.
There was no schism within the Anglican communion, as some had predicted, and we've been given a breathing space of about 9 months to allow a further coherence to develop within the Anglican communion. So all of this is very positive.
Anglican theologian Father Bill Franklin is a former member of the Anglican Roman Catholic Dialogue in the United States. He told me more about the key points worked out by the bishops in Tanzania.
Three important proposals are to be worked out. Two have to do with the House of bishops of the Episcopal Church being asked to speak clearly to two issues. One, to agree clearly not to consent to the consecration of a publicly gay bishop in the future. And second, to state clearly that the House of Bishops will not authorize diocesan liturgical blessings of same-sex unions. The third issue is that provinces from outside of the United States have been asked not to interfere in the ecclesial affairs of the Episcopal Church in the United States. That is to say, not to set up provinces of their own nations out of parishes that have seceded from the Episcopal Church in the United States.
The Archbishop of Canterbury calls these proposals a challenge, a big challenge for both sides, the traditionalists and the liberal wing of the American church. Do you think these proposals are likely to be fulfilled within the end of this year?
My guess is that the proposals certainly will be fulfilled in the Episcopal Church. I believe that the House of Bishops will make such a statement. It came very close to that at the General Convention of 2006. And I think no statement has ever been published by the House of Bishops authorizing liturgical blessings of same-sex couples in dioceses. So my guess is that there will be an accommodation on the part of the Episcopal Church. And my hope is that, in fact, provinces from outside of the Episcopal Church will now desist from interfering in the ecclesial affairs of the United States.
The Tanzania statement also puts a lot of emphasis on what it calls this listening process, listening to the experiences of homosexuals within the communion. How important do you think this is for the resolution of this crisis?
Well, I believe that it is the flip side of the coin of asking the Episcopal Church not to consecrate gay bishops at the moment, because the Windsor report, the document which is leading to a process of reconciliation in the communion, has asked the entire communion to be in conversation with gay and lesbian people about their spiritual lives and how they live out those lives in the life of the church. And I think there now needs to be a much more exerted effort throughout the communion to set up processes of listening and report back to the communion as a whole as a way to prepare for the Lambeth Conference in 2008, which will be the next occasion where all of the bishops of the Anglican Communion can consider these issues of human sexuality, where the root cause of disunity at the moment within the life of our communion.
As you say, this Lambeth Conference will be a main focus of whether the communion can continue, can find some kind of cohesion and agreement over this important issue. What are your hopes for that conference?
Well, I think the Lambeth Conference of 2008, the meeting of all the bishops of the Anglican Communion in England, which happens every 10 years, will be the next important occasion for the communion to gather after the Tanzania meeting. And the very fact is that all of the primates stayed together at the table of conversation in Tanzania. This, to me, is a sign that they are very likely to gather in England in 2008 and continue this conversation. So that the spirit of dialogue has been maintained in Tanzania, and I predict that it will continue in the next months. And the response of the Episcopal Church will be a way to contribute to that dialogue, and listening to gay and lesbian Christians will be another way to contribute to that dialogue. So all of this seems to me to be in keeping with the Anglican tradition, which is held today in the midst of this very tense crisis over human sexuality.
There were those who were pointing to the fact that there were a number of bishops who refused to take communion together with the presiding Bishop Catherine in the United States. They were pointing to this as, in fact, signs of much deeper tensions under the surface.
Well, in fact, at this meeting in Tanzania, 7 to 8 primates did not receive communion with the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. But at the last meeting of the primates, 19 primates did not. So if you're keeping score, the score seems to have gone down. And I think, again, this is a sign of a much more peaceful and cohesive meeting than many had expected to take place in Tanzania.
What do you think this is due to? I mean, it does seem that there is a slightly more positive atmosphere now than there was, say, a few months ago. What do you think this is largely due to?
Well, I think it partly because of the goodwill on the parts of both the conservatives and the liberals in the communion to try to avoid any deep division within the Anglican communion. So that my sense is that both sides have tried to enter into the debate in a much more humble fashion than at the beginning of this crisis in 2003. And it's also important to say that the cohesion of the communion has also been strongly supported by the Holy See. The Holy See, in its contribution through the YARCM process to the Windsor Report, encouraged the cohesion of the Anglican Communion. I think the recent meeting of the Pope with Archbishop Rowan Williams was another meeting which encouraged the spirit of dialogue and openness and cohesion. So all of these developments, in which the Holy See has also played a part, led to this atmosphere in Africa when parties worked hard to try to keep the communion together, fearing the disaster that would emerge if this communion really split into deeply divided fragments.
The communion is looking to drawing up a covenant, isn't it, to which all the provinces will have to adhere to provide for the first time a real framework for the Anglican Communion. Can you tell us a bit more about this? When is it likely to happen, for example?
Well, at this meeting in Tanzania, there was a draft of a covenants statement, which essentially would be a rephrasing of classical elements of the Christian faith, which have held Anglicans together for 400 years, an emphasis on the Book of Common Prayer, an emphasis on the basic elements of the Christian faith. So I see nothing in this proposed document, the covenant, which parts of the communion, like the Episcopal Church in the United States, could not well approve of. So I was appreciative of the classical tone of the statement, of the fact that it grows out of historic Anglicanism, and it's merely a further elaboration of elements which have, in fact, held Anglicans together for four centuries. So I think the tone of this statement itself allowed a greater cohesion at the Tanzania meeting.
What would be the novelty, though, of this covenant, and when is it likely to appear?
The novelty of the covenant is that it will be a much longer statement than our previous statement of cohesion, the quadrilateral, which had only 4 points. It was only 4 sentences long. I mean, this statement runs to 20 to 30 pages and is a much more elaborate discussion of Anglicanism. My guess is that there will be several drafts and the final covenant might be signed at the Lambeth Conference of 2008, which would therefore be the end product of this entire period discussing what are the basic elements and frameworks to keep the Anglican community together. At the moment, it seems that those elements and frameworks are holding until the Lambeth Conference, and this is very good news indeed.
And my thanks there to Anglican theologian Father Bill Franklin, a former member of the Anglican Roman Catholic Dialogue in the United States. Meanwhile, in Britain, the Catholic Diocese of Westminster has extended what it calls its pastoral outreach to the homosexual community with the celebration of Mass twice a month that it says is particularly aimed at the concerns of this group of Catholics. Though the diocese already offers a listening service for gay Catholics, the new initiative is in response to an increasing awareness on the part of the Church of their particular pastoral needs.
For some time, there's been a process of reflection within the Diocese of Westminster on its pastoral outreach, in particular, to homosexual Catholics within our own diocese.
Bishop Bernard Longley is auxiliary in the Diocese of Westminster with responsibility for the West End area of London where these masses are being held. I asked him what prompted this new effort at outreach to the city's gay community.
Some time ago, 2 years ago, the Cardinal appointed a senior priest from the diocese to be his point of reference for this pastoral ministry to develop appropriate contacts with Roman Catholics who are homosexual and to try to work out the best way of providing for people who are struggling with their own sexuality but wanting to be a full part of the Catholic Church. And also, I think, in encouraging people to look to their own parishes and to help them to integrate within parish life. So after this fairly lengthy period of reflection, it became clear that there is a particular place in central London called Soho where quite large numbers of homosexuals do gather, congregate and meet. And it seemed that it was opportune to make some particular provision in a parish. It's quite a small number of people who live in that part of London, but it is hoped that in the ordinary setting of a parish in central London, there'll be an opportunity to encourage Catholics to deepen their communion with the Church, with our Lord through the Mass, but also to encourage them to look to their home parishes as places where they can be fully a part of the parish community.
Now, this is being seen as a Mass just for the gay community, but you don't see it in such exclusive terms, do you?
No, I think that's true to say. What has been given particular attention, I think, is that the celebrants of the Mass are sensitive to the issues which many homosexual Catholics will bring to that celebration when they come together. But the Mass itself will be the ordinary, regular celebration of the Sunday liturgy. We don't want to encourage the development of some kind of ghetto or some kind of quasi-community within the Catholic Church in central London. But we want this to be a step or a stage on the way to listening to the Church's teaching and to reflecting on it and really to deepening communion within the life of the Church.
Now, you're talking about sensitivity to particularly the issues that gay Catholics will bring with them. And one of these is the perception that the church is not, perhaps not necessarily hostile, but not really sensitive to the needs, the particular needs of this community. Is it a kind of response to that, would you say?
In some quarters, there is a perception that the Catholic Church is not seen as sensitive. But in fact, we wanted to reflect the teaching of the Church. We wanted to reflect what the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith say about the particular pastoral care which the bishop must have. And also, its awareness that homosexual people, including homosexual Catholics, may themselves experience unjust discrimination. So this really is an opportunity to reassure, to be clear about what the Church teaches, but also to reassure people that they, in their relationship with our Lord, in the relationship with the Church, that they have an opportunity to be fully part of the life of the Church.
Are you expecting a very large attendance? Do you know of many families, many people who would already be interested in this kind of service?
Well, you mentioned families. The senior priest I mentioned earlier, whom the Cardinal has appointed for as a point of reference, has already been celebrating a Mass in his parish regularly, and it's been made known that homosexual Catholics, their families, their parents, those who are concerned about issues that they face, would be particularly welcome. And so a small number have been coming to that Mass, and we wouldn't be expecting very large numbers, I think a fairly modest number, but nevertheless significant for each of the individuals and important for them that they know that the Church welcomes them as any other baptized Catholic within the Catholic community. And what is fundamental is that they are regarded because of their innate dignity as being made in the image and likeness of God.
What has been the reaction to this within the secular society there in London? I mean, is it somehow being seen as perhaps a changing in church teaching?
So far, it's really, I would say it's early days to gauge, and we haven't, as a diocese, there hasn't been any immediate or direct reaction to this. There has been some reporting within the Catholic press, but on the whole, I think this provision is understood because it's part of something which began some time ago. And within the groups of homosexual Catholics, there has been expressed a welcome for this opportunity.
There are also other services that the diocese already provides, like, for example, a listening service, isn't there, that's been going on for some time?
That's quite right, yes. A number of priests of the diocese are available in a church within the central area of London, an adjacent church, in fact, and they offer what they call a listening service so that there is an opportunity on a Friday evening regularly for people simply to come to talk about their concerns and also to reflect the fullness of the Church's teaching on human sexuality as part of a human person's life. I think to emphasise the fact that the Church doesn't see people according to their sexuality, their sexual orientation, that their identity is something which is far greater than that, although that is an important aspect of it.
My thanks there to Bishop Bernard Longley, Auxiliary of the Diocese of Westminster in the United Kingdom. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Don't forget you can always find us at www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.